this morning, we are visiting with Henry Gadbois. It is May the 19th, 2006. Henry, let's go back to the early 50s or before. Tell me, were you born in Houston?
Yes, native Houstonian. I'm a St. Joseph baby. even had a certificate that they were, you were trying to raise money and they sent everybody a certificate. But no, grew up here in Houston and went to schools, West University Elementary, then Lamar, and then the University of Houston. Got my BFA degree in 52 there and the master's in 53. I was thinking about what to say on a interview sort of thing, about who was influenced. And, you know, I can remember practically every teacher I had in first grade was Miss Wilson, who put one of my drawings up on the wall. Which,
bravo.
So I must have had some artistic talent. My father was an artist, too, so I had been exposed. He was a commercial artist, worked for Madison Southwest, which he painted the big outdoor billboards. He was very violently objected to abstract art. We always had good arguments back and forth. But these huge heads that he painted on the billboards, I said he was one of the first pop artists, and he didn't even know it. But, I mean, he could paint, you know, from a small sketch, you know, a 10-foot head. Mm-hmm. And it looked, from the distance, it looked great. But anyway, then I think one of the first, the third grade, Mrs. Reed, we did a social studies book, and there was another boy in the class, Bobby Martin, who was actually a better drawer than I was, but we illustrated the essays. So that was another first artistic achievement. And there was Mrs. Wood in the fifth grade, who's the mother of Johnny Houchins, who is an architect here in town. She was, instead of having to go to the music side when you had art and music, she kept me in the art side double time. So, I mean, there were people that, you know, spurred me on from the very beginning. And, of course, my father was in a group of men here in town that they were commercial artists. And they had a studio down in the old M&M building. This was in the 30s,
which
the late 30s.
University of Houston.
University of Houston downtown now.
Mm-hmm.
And during the Depression, the man couldn't rent anything, so he gave them the space. Unfortunately, it was on the south side of the building rather than the north side. But anyway, these men would go down in the evening and paint. There was still lives. They would hire a model sometimes on Sundays, or they would go out on trips. I know I gave one of my dad's paintings to the Plains Museum, Church in Gonzales, the
mm-hmm.
mission, and they would go on field trips or they would go down to the bio.
Wonderful.
And some of his, you know.
Oh.
But anyway, the Amaryllis back there, the painting is by my father.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. So, I mean, I would be watching him paint, so I knew I picked up a lot from my father. And probably one of the greatest influences was my high school art teacher, Norma Henderson.
Mm-hmm.
Who also taught Jack Boynton and Dick Ray. She reminded me one time that Dick Ray, all he did was sit in the back of the room drawing cartoons. I've told Dick this. He said, yeah, that's right, that's right. So, but Norma remained
at Lamar High School.
At Lamar High School.
Mm-hmm.
And Norma remained dear friends with both Leela and me for the rest of her life. And Norma herself really didn't paint that much. I do have one sort of painting that she did. But we really felt like her apartment was her canvas. I mean, she had wonderful color sense. And she was a really good friend of Kelly Fairing's.
Mm-hmm.
She introduced us to Kelly, and Kelly became a good friend of ours. But Norma's apartment would constantly change in colors, and she would buy these Persian bedspreads out at Cargo Houston in the early days of the 50s when they were out at Westbury Square and hang them on the wall, or a bedroom would be turned into a dining room one time. Or she was
very creative.
Really very creative, even though she didn't paint that much. And then she also introduced me to, in ceramics, the first thing I ever exhibited was a small bowl that I did when I was still in high school. It was in the Texas General in 47, I think. So I started exhibiting, nearly 60 years ago now. The ceramics done in Norma's class and the drawings and things like that. She introduced me to Lowell Alden, who had a studio here. He was a ceramist. And down at the YWCA, they had a good studio. The kiln and the drying racks were on the first floor in the studio. And I remember Alvin Romansky was, that's another one. They're too late now, but he would have been a good interview. So I would, as a teenager, I'd be taking the class. I took classes from Ruth Euler at the museum. I wasn't a very good student, I don't think. It was more the fun of just going to the museum rather than being serious about doing paintings. But then I went to the University of Houston. It was at a great change at the time of the U of H. Frederick Brown at that time was retiring in 48, and Bernie Lemmel was the new head of the department. He was also the sculpture teacher, Bernhard Lemmel. And it was the start of their new Bachelor of Fine Arts program, where you took basically all art, or three art classes each semester with labs. Mm-hmm. So, you were in the classroom for quite a bit of the time. And I think while I was there, I took from Robert Prusser and also Lowell Collins. I remember the life drawing instructor, I won't mention his name, but in my sophomore year, I really didn't like his style of teaching. Mm-hmm. In charcoal drawing in life class, he had what's called a stub, which is like you sharpen a piece of cardboard stick sort of thing, and you smear the charcoal. He liked sharp, very realistic, nudie nudes. So talking to Lowell, who was teaching a class at the Museum of Fine Arts School at the time in the evening, he got me a scholarship to go every Tuesday and Thursday evening to his life class, which was the Nicolotti method of gesture drawings and fast. And it was a great group. Gertrude Barnstone, or Gertrude Levy, was in the class. Andy Todd, who was an architect. Mm-hmm. Bob Lent, an architect. Derek Taylor, who was an Englishman that worked for Channel 13, I think, in the sets and things like that, was in the class, too. One story about Derek. When Salvador Dali was in town, when the CAA had an exhibit of his work, mm-hmm. he was interviewed at Channel 13, that's over on Bissonnette, I think. So interviewing Salvador Dali, Derek was talking to him about art, and he showed me on one of the sets there, Salvador Dali had drawn a little fly. So I don't think Derek ever cut it out. A fly on the wall, and he didn't sign it, but if you have provenance that Salvador Dali, you'd have a fortune today. It's probably underneath 10 coats of paint out there today. But it was a great class, and after class, we would all go down to 2K's on Main Street mm-hmm. and have coffee or raisin toast or whatever it was. And George Fearman, who was a columnist at the time for the Houston Post, would come in also about finishing up his day. And I remember one time Lowell did caricatures of the people, quick pencil drawings, just maybe 2 inches high, small drawings in his sketchbook of the people around there. And Fearman saw him one time and was so intrigued by him, he asked to borrow them, and they appeared in the Houston Post one day, these caricatures of people. Okay. But anyway, all these caricatures of the people in 2K. So, it was a very stimulating, exciting time. Of course, like when you're 18 or 19 or in the early 20s, anything's stimulating and exciting, especially when you're running with an older crowd. But I just told you that we were down at the exhibit at the Heritage Society with Randy Tibbetts and talking.
Mm-hmm.
And I said that in 1952 it was, I did a painting of a wicker rocking chair that I still have today in the paintings on the stairway up there. And I was working in a style of really umber washes and things, of where you would sort of draw in the chair, and a lot of times I would draw like Nicolotti did with the left hand to get a freer drawing of the object, and then put these umber washes on it, and then with the brush you could sort of scrub over to an edge and create an edge with the leftover paint. So it's very thin on the canvas, and sort of in washes of that. And I distinctly recall I painted them flat on the floor. I had my studio was at my parents' house in the room above the garage that my mother allowed me to change any way I wanted. It was really a great meeting place for friends, too. And I knew then that that was a completed work. I was no longer a student.
Mm-hmm.
I knew that this was a finished piece of art, and I was, from there on, you know, I was no longer the student, I was the artist, and I just knew it then.
Mm-hmm.
Then I did another one in the studio table I had made, also during, I guess during the early 50s, I know who wasn't in that show, Pat Colville or Pat Holston.
Well, I was thinking about that.
She exhibited in the Houston shows, and she's was here in Houston recently. But Pat and Lowell and I had a company. We got interested, or Lowell did, and then he got us interested in cloisonné, or enamelware on copper.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a little kiln, and in my studio up above the garage, we would meet every Sunday, and we would make enamel jewelry, earrings and cufflinks and stuff like that. And we sold them at Neiman Marcus.
Really?
Yeah. I think they were selling for like maybe $25 a pair of earrings, so we got $10. And they were usually like little chips, maybe 3/4 inch by 1/2 inch, and they would be abstract and colorful designs in the enamel.
Uh-huh.
And then we would solder the backs onto it. In those days you had the screw type backs.
Mm-hmm.
But we had a little business going for several years that we would work up there and have the Sunday afternoon mystery radio shows playing while we listened to them and while we were working away.
And you, it was you and Lowell
and Pat Colville.
And Pat Colville.
Or Pat Halsall then.
Mm-hmm.
Or she was Pat Halsall then, she's Pat Colville now.
Mm-hmm.
But,
how fun.
I know it, yeah. And then, you know, right after, and also, sort of from the very beginning, another very influential person, a helpful person, was Ben Dubose.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in charge of the art department at Butte Company, which was downtown on Caroline, I believe, in the paint store.
Mm-hmm.
And in the middle of the paint store, there was one aisle that was all art supplies and things like that. And at the end of that was a room that was a gallery. And I think probably it was one of the first commercial galleries in the city. I think there was, not Mannheim, but something began with an M, a frame shop that also was a gallery at the time. And then I think Stowers Furniture Company had a gallery.
Well, when did Catherine have her gallery?
Catherine Swenson?
Uh-huh.
Oh, way later.
Much later.
Later.
So
yeah.
Ben was maybe...
He was really the first one. And he even gave, like, the... I have the list of it. The art club at the University of Houston, he gave us the space in the gallery,
mm-hmm,
to have a show. And then also, I remember, I even bought one of them, one of the early Herb Mears and David Attucks shows when they first came back from France. So that must have been
that's in the
late
50s.
40s or early 50s,
yeah.
Then. So then And Ben would give us leftover mis-sized frames or ends of the rolls of canvases or something. I mean, he was really generous to the students,
yeah.
to the young artists. And then Buttes then moved over to West Gray.
Mm-hmm.
And at first they were on the corner where Vera Paredes was, and then they moved into the middle of that shopping center over, the River Oak Shopping Center. And I guess that's... I don't remember when my first one-man show was, but, you know, sometimes...
Was it on West Gray? When DuBose was on
yeah,
West Gray?
Yeah, well, Buttes. It was still Buttes.
Still Buttes.
Yeah. And then it wasn't really until 1966 when Ben left Buttes and then formed his own gallery that was DuBose on Kirby Drive. And most of us, you know, went over there with Ben.
Now that building, did he build that with Tommy Dickey, or was that already there?
Yeah, I can't remember if it was already, I think it was already there.
Because that's that Dickey property.
Yeah, no, it was rented, from Dickey. Dickey owned all the
lot. Dickey,
and
yeah.
steal all the apartments on
oh,
Street,
yeah.
Street and all of that, yeah.
Do you remember Henry, when that gallery, when DuBose was opened?
1966. Yeah. In fact, somewhere around here I have a photograph where all the artists were out in front by the DuBose sign.
You need to get that.
And it was the evening. And I think the lights went out or the air conditioning went off or something, but then it
came back
on. And, you know, I think as Khalil says in her, that it was very social on the Friday night opening over at DuBose.
Oh, sure.
I mean, it was a good
place.
It was a place to go.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, everybody sort of met there.
Mm-hmm.
And Ben did a good job of selling. Ben had, he loved sort of a messy gallery of where you'd have to sort of go through and sort of find something,
mm-hmm.
you know, that was already there.
Mm-hmm.
But, or he would say, oh, some people are really liking yellow. He never told you exactly what to paint, but he would sort of give you hints that people are really painting their houses walls yellow. So,
mm-hmm.
Or it sort of chided you if you hadn't been painting. And I think really about in the 60s, I was probably doing about 100 paintings a year, which is, I can't imagine me doing that much.
That's a lot.
That's a lot.
Mm-hmm. Particularly the way you paint, that's
yeah.
a lot.
Yeah.
Well, he couldn't chide you for not...
Well, no, I don't... It was just... I remember one time, there was one show, it was a group show, and the painting was wet, and a lady touched it and got paint on her finger. But anyway, so, I mean, it was a lively thing, everything going around. Oh, also, right after I finished college, the master's
mm-hmm.
thing. I got a job. I was hired at the Museum of Fine Arts. This was in 1953. And at that time, Lee Malone was just taking over as director. And they had some man from Tennessee Gas that was sort of contracted out to the museum or given to the museum to help
mm-hmm.
establish a new personnel and sort of direction for the museum with Lee Malone. And so I was hired as registrar, and then later on, because they didn't have a business manager on some of the programs, I was listed as business manager, which I had nothing to do with the business end of the museum. And at that time, the registrar was basically checking in paintings that were arriving for shows and making sure that James, the custodian, was packing the paintings. I mean, things were loose. I remember I talked to Philippe de Montebello one night about working at the museum in 1953. We had one guard, Mr. Sorsby, and we had really one basic custodian, James, who was also a wino that sometimes would come and sometimes not.
That wrapped up the paintings that he shipped.
Yeah, and then there was a young man that came in while I was there. But Virginia Ekman was Malone's secretary, and I had, it was in the part of the building, his office and the old library was on the Montrose side in the original 1926 wing, the second addition to the regular museum. And so I was sort of adjoining, it was just a wall dividing, so I was in the office with Lee, so, you know, when he would have people in.
Well, it was a different time. I mean, I remember back in the 70s, well, mid to late 70s, when I was getting into the business, and I would do a commission with a letter agreement.
Yeah.
And that's all it was.
Well, I think like for the Van Gogh show, if you can imagine the amount of money in today's terms that little exhibit, and really the only security, they did have an alarm system at the CAA building, but it didn't work all the time. And I know during the Van Gogh show, Frank Dileska slept down there at night. He was sort of the guard. But I don't think anybody thought of stealing a Van Gogh in those days.
No. Well, when you think about the early 50s to, let's just say, the late 60s,
okay,
what happened in Houston? I mean, what kind of... Is it just kind of a seamless maturation, or more things were coming in?
Yeah. I remember when I was in high school with Norma, she was telling me about, and it was the first show at that time, so it must have been late 40s when the CAA was formed, and their first show was that, I think, utility items like irons and coffee makers and stuff. And I think Frank Dileska did the installation. It was in the upstairs galleries on Montrose at the Museum of Fine Arts. And he used a lot of strings back and forth that sort of led you from one area to the other. Oh, also another thing Norma introduced me to was the 809 Pacific. Have you ever heard about that?
No.
The building's probably still there. It was an old building, a two-story building. And it was artist studios. Buck Shewitz and Ruby Lee had a studio there. Lowell Alden did. The apartment in the front was owned by, his family owned a furniture store here in Houston. He was a big ballet enthusiast. But I know Norma took me over there one day to show me, it was near Christmas time, that she had done a Christmas tree decoration in her studio. And it was basically a very angular black cardboard thing, and with a light in front of it, so it wasn't the object itself that was the tree, it was the image that was projected, the shadow against the wall, which was the... So I would get all the contemporary feelings from Norma, and then I would argue that with my father, and he would give me the traditional side of it, and I would take it back to Norma. And so I was using the two of them sort of arguing back and forth. But, yeah, Buck had a studio, and then Lila may be able to tell you who it was, but, you know, when the Ballet Russe came every Christmas for the performances, and the wonderful performances of Gaieté Parisienne, but anyway, this young man would have parties for the...
At 809 Pacific.
At 809 Pacific, yeah. So, I mean, there were a lot of fun things that went on there. I was really a little too young to really enjoy that thing at the time. If I'd been maybe 4 or 5 years older, then it would have been all right. But with the CAA starting, though, I mean, it was a volunteer organization.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody did their part. If you were on the board, you were probably program director or you were in charge. And people would come up with ideas for shows.
Mm-hmm.
And then they would be in charge of that, like one marvelous show. And of course, the CAA was down next door to the Kellam Noble House in Sam Houston Park at that time. That's where it was built. There's a parking lot there now.
That was before the park became Heritage Park? Or was it already?
Well, I think it was always Sam Houston Park. There was the Kellam Noble House was already there. I
mean, it was on its original site.
Its original site.
Right.
And I can't remember if any of the other houses, the Cherry House probably had already been moved. I don't know when it was moved there.
Could have been.
I'd have to check the dates. But the CAA was that very A-frame contemporary little building that McKean
Who was the moving one person that started CAA, or was it a group that got together?
I think it was a group together. Preston Bolton, I'm sure, was one of the early ones, and you know, I really don't know.
That really sparked
it. It was a group of people that were interested. Oh, and I know also too, early on, Hugh Gregg, who was an architect here, he had, I'd have to ask him, but with a couple of other people, a contemporary, they carried Charles Eames furniture.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was called Pasco.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember I bought two for my little studio. I bought two black Eames chairs. Unfortunately, I didn't buy the wooden, I bought the metal leg ones, which are not selling as much nowadays as the wood leg ones are.
Mm-hmm.
But I think they were $28.
I could believe that.
Yeah, yeah. And then I can't remember, but there were some architects in the group, but I really don't know. Because I got into the CAA a little bit later on in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
Because after I left the museum, I was drafted in the Army, and then I was gone for a year and a half, 2 years. And when I had gotten back, I remember Lila had sent me the clippings of when they moved the Contemporary Arts Museum down Main Street after midnight to the new location at the Prudential Building on Fannin.
Now, was it behind the existing Prudential Building, or where did it actually sit?
Okay, the Prudential Building faces on Holcomb.
Holcomb, right.
Okay, so it was a little back piece of property, sort of maybe at their back corner. The CIA faced on Fannin. So if you have Fannin, the Prudential's in front on Holcomb, and sort of toward the back of their property. I mean, you could see the building right there. It was,
mm-hmm.
you know, on the property.
Was that, did Prudential lend the CAA land?
Yeah, uh-huh. They gratis, they allowed them to use the land.
Mm-hmm.
For I don't know how many years. And somebody asked me, I know the new Contemporary Arts Museum was built in the early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know, was the old CAA, I've never heard, was it dismantled, wrecked, or?
No one's mentioned that to me.
I don't know whatever happened to the building itself.
We'll have to ask. Jim Love might have known, but he didn't mention it.
Yeah, because he worked there with Jerry McAvey.
Right.
And, of course, earlier at the CIA, downtown, Algie Mears was like the secretary.
She might
know. Yeah, yeah. And then Frank Dileschka was sort of the handyman. He installed the place. And I know when I was in Germany, in Nuremberg, there was a neat little museum there that had traveling shows, and they had a German graphics show that impressed me very, very much. And I think Jerry McAgee by this time had taken over the CAA as director. And I suggested doing a German graphics show. So I collected, I remember I would get the things in from over the apartment of one of my sergeants. So anyway, we brought, and when I got back, I think that I got back in May or something like that, that it was, the show was like in June or something like that.
May of 1956.
Mm-hmm. And it was so popular that people were buying the graphics. And of course, in addition, I know I kept mailing back to Germany, you know, sending the money to the CAA would send the money to the artists in Germany. I can't remember, it was Joanna Bluschke and Otto Eglau, and I can't remember all of them that were in the show. But we sold quite a few.
How fun.
Yeah.
I'm sure it was stimulating.
Yeah. And then, of course, the CAA had the art rental at the time, too, for all those years. I remember one year I was, I guess, program chairman, so I was in charge of getting the exhibits installed. I know Charles Shorey had done an exhibit that year, and I think the one he did was a photographic exhibit, and he had designed sort of canopies. Well, the CAA, it was funny, I remember we had one New Year's Eve party at the CAA for the members where the whole CAA had Christmas trees hung upside down from the ceiling with the decoration. I think we really wanted to try to be far out.
Uh-huh. You know, well, have fun.
On the edge. Just, we did have fun.
Uh-huh.
And then also the CAA had like a craft show or something like that where you could buy, I have one, a Jim Love Dirty Bird.
Uh-huh.
They were $10 a piece.
And, you know, I wish I had been here to get one of those.
And a lot of, I have a good collection of, we would trade.
Mm-hmm.
I have an early Boynton in there from 53 when he had the biggest Boynton show. I think I paid a month's salary for the painting, but I've enjoyed it since 53.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you traded back and forth. Oh, and then another thing that as a group, the Friday night print group that Bill Condon had
pulled together.
He was hair tour director. I mean, he would get people, and he discovered something called paper lithography. Instead of using stones, it's a sheet of paper that was treated, and you would draw like you do on the stone with the crayon,
mm-hmm.
and then you would put some sort of acid on top of it, and you would run it through just a press. And I think we had an old washing machine roller was the press. And, oh, I can't remember, Gertrude was in the group, and then we also did etchings too. But Gertrude was in the group, Alvin Romansky, Leela, Stella, Elaine Mass, Bill, of course. And the museum let us use the studio every Friday night.
That was nice. So down there,
yeah. Yeah.
Now, Bill Condon, what happened to him?
He died. He had cancer, and he died probably about 5 or 6 years ago.
Uh-huh. I didn't remember when he died.
Yeah. He was the best man at our wedding.
He was? Well, I've seen his work here and there over the years.
He's a remarkable person. You know, for the catalog, for the Houston Art Collection, mm-hmm. his biography is sort of non-existent. We really need to check with his... he has some nieces that probably could fill us in. And we traveled to Europe with Bill a couple of times, and he would talk about his childhood, which was the parents had been divorced and they were sort of moving around a bit. So it was he said he didn't learn how to read until the third grade. He fooled all the teachers up to that point, but then he felt like it was easier to go ahead and learn how to read than try and fool people. But they said even at Rice when he first came, that even as a freshman, his presentations were unusual and different from the normal.
Mm-hmm.
Entering student. And then in the war, he lost both of his legs stepping on a landmine in Germany. So they used to tease him when he came back. He was in a wheelchair at first, but finishing up his degree. But then when he got his legs, he was about an inch and a half taller than he was before he left. So they said, I guess with two false legs, you can be any height you want to be. But when we were traveling, he would keep all of his money in his fake legs.
Fake legs.
And he said, Bill, you know what? He said, well, if they steal my legs, you know, steal my money, I've lost anyway. But
he was pretty smart.
He was a delightful, delightful person.
I'm sure. Well, now, let's think about Ben DuBose moves over to his gallery to Kirby, 1966. And then... what was going on in Houston then? At that time you had David Gallery, Kiko Gallery, Catherine
yeah.
Swenson's gallery was probably functioning then.
Yeah, probably even a little bit earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And can you think of anything else?
Oh, the Cushman Gallery.
Cushman Gallery.
Leela was with the Cushman Gallery for a while. And then she was also Polly Marsters,
mm-hmm.
had the gallery that was in the building on Main Street near Alabama, where Preston Frazier had his Ferroy Candle Company in the basement, and then it was were handmakers after Preston moved to his factory. Handmakers moved in there, Are you familiar with Handmakers?
I remember hearing about it.
It was a whole group of artists together, Stella Sullivan, Frank Valeska, I can't remember who else, but they were craftsmen, and it was a cooperative of where they would sell their own things, you know, and then I think then they hired, I can't remember the lady's name, when they moved to the Galleria, and then they started, you know, buying other things, but handcrafted sort of type items.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But Stella did, like, fabrics, textiles, printed, and I know glasses with designs that she had drawn.
And Polly Marsters had a gallery?
Yeah, and it was called the Houston Artist Gallery, which is sort of the same Houston Artist Gallery that Grace Spaulding Johnson and Ruth Bueller had in the 20s. It was
and
the
it
same
kind of
name.
Evolved into...
No,
no,
I mean,
it's a different story.
Yeah, it's different, but Polly it selected the same name.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the David Gallery. I think it was down here on... Diane David had the... and.
Where was that gallery?
On San Felipe here, right back here, down. It was in her house. What was the mother's name?
I don't know. Way before my
Grace David. Grace David. All right. And then the daughter was dying. And the gallery is in the back. The son had the bookstore in the front on San Felipe. And
that was down from Meredith.
Yeah, just a little bit. Mm-hmm. Not very. Yeah, very close. And they had a show one time. It was an eye opener for me. It was the tattoo show. And they had asked artists, and this time it was probably, I know Jack Boynton had it, I can't remember who else was invited to submit a piece of work that had been influenced by a tattoo, which was pretty weird. But then that evening, they had a little section in there of where there was a tattoo artist. And the first 10 people who wanted a little tattoo could get it free, and then you had to pay. But then they had people that had tattoos. And the ladies at that time, you know, nudity was just verboten, but the ladies that had the tattoos all over had like a knitted vest on that you could sort of see through, or they would open it up, but they would have flowers tattooed all over the chest. And then there were a couple of men there that had quite a few tattoos. And first time I'd ever seen it, one man turned around. They were shirtless down just to the waist. And he turned around, and he had an earring through his nipple, which just my stomach just went boing, you know.
That's
1960. In the 60s, somewhere early, early.
Early.
Oh, another Roy Fridge. Was mm-hmm. He showed at the David Gallery.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Got all these names started.
It's fun to think about that.
Yeah, I have a couple of them. Well, that's one of these little machines, Roy Fridge.
Uh-huh. Wonderful.
Yeah. Oh, they're fantastic. Yeah.
Wonderful. Well, if you could summarize and talk about your sense of Houston growing up or maturing, or did it, or was it just sort of an ongoing kind of flow of change that happened over a 20-year period that led into the 70s, which offered more change as time went by?
Yeah, you know, with the local art, and in Khalil's thing,
okay.
In the catalog,
mm-hmm.
and also at the Cassetta meeting, Houston's very different. I mean, it didn't have a strong leader like Dallas and Fort Worth had. I can't remember the director of the museum that were Jack at the time was, but it was the Fort Worth Museum of Art. I mean, he really pushed
local.
The local people. It was almost like a school, and boy, they were exhibiting here, they were exhibiting there. They're like, he got them into the World's Fair in Brussels, and I mean, he really was pushing the local art. We never had anyone here that was really strong on the local art, and then, you know, that might be bad to remain too local. You know, you've got to sort of spread
their wings
out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think it was with the beginning of the CIA, of where they were bringing in other things that were happening in other parts of the country, new things like the mid-century furniture, as it's now designated as, with designs. And I think a lot of the architects were sort of pushing at the time, especially like Howard Barnstone, Preston Bolton with their company. It was for the new and sort of the modern.
Mm-hmm.
And I know when I got back from the Army, I knew I wanted to do abstract things. And so for all the late 50s into the early, well, not the 60s, but all through the 50s, I was completely abstract.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we went to Europe in 1960, I knew I wanted to do something called field patterns and sort of simple flat areas of the land. And then we stayed in Florence for 6 weeks, did 30 paintings there, had a show at Buttes. They were all about like 24 by 30. And so that sort of led me to the landscape, and I've been at the landscape ever since. So
that's where I came to know your work, because I came in 1975. So.
And flowers and things. So, you know, I became a much more traditional painter. I think as much as I fought against my father with traditionalism earlier, the more and more as I get along, I'm probably more like my father, his landscapes that he did in the 30s and 40s.
Well, Henry, that's not uncommon.
No, I know.
Most young people reach out and they want to go the opposite direction.
And then they make the
circle
and come right.
They make a circle
right,
and somehow we all are related.
That's right.
That comes out. Now, you and Leela met.
Well, we had met, well, we say we had never met, because we always knew each other at the museum. She was a student in the museum school. She remembers me as a teenager there. She was young. And I remember one of the things, there was in an Easter art show, a wonderful little figure of a girl that I really did like. She wouldn't sell it, though. And I keep teasing her, I had to marry her to get that.
You mean she had done?
She had done, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I had to marry her to get.
Well, Henry, there you go.
So we were in the group together on Friday, and I think something clicked just before I went into the Army. And then we were married after I got back.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll be 50 years coming up this August.
Oh, boy, well, congratulations.
Yeah.
That's wonderful. Well, is there anything else you want to think of? Okay.
I've chatted away enough, I think.
Well, this has been this is a good recollection. I mean, it really is. It'll be, it's very informative.